certainly the decision of the United States Supreme Court rendered on February 24th, 1971 on Miranda bears out that we are indeed in a strong rightist trend of government. That decision ruled that although under the famous Miranda against Arizona case, a confession that is obtained without warning a person of his constitutional rights and without affording him the right of counsel cannot be used against him at a trial. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court now is saying, if the defendant on such a trial testifies in his own behalf, that confession, which was illegally obtained from him, may be used to impeach his own testimony. In other words, the only way a person can protect himself under the Miranda decision from now on, that is, the only way he can make sure that and a confession illegally obtained will not be used against him in court, is by refusing to testify on his own behalf. It is obvious by this decision of the United States Supreme Court that the Miranda opinion is seriously undermined. And this, of course, is only further indication that Nixon has obtained the 5-4 majority that he has been seeking on the court. More restrictive decisions in the area of civil rights may be expected. Also, although the New York Times today hails the decision of the United States Court of Appeals in the Sostra case, the fact is that the United States Court of Appeals limited the ruling of Judge Constance Baker Motley awarding civil rights to prisoners serving time in state prisons. Mrs. Motley had ruled that a person could not be subjected to solitary confinement for more than 15 days without that violating the Constitution's ban on cruel and inhuman treatment. That was not sustained by the Court of Appeals. Furthermore, although a judgment that Sostra won of damages against the correction commissioner and the warden was sustained, it was sustained only as to the warden, and the warden is dead, and it has not been decided whether the damages can be collected from his estate. Furthermore, in giving the right of trial to prisoners accused of violations inside the prison, the Court of Appeals ruled that the prisoners were entitled to a hearing, but not all the safeguards of a trial. It is unfortunate that the Court of Appeals in this way limited the effect of Constance Baker Motley's decision. Finally, a few words should be stated on the position of the United States government regarding the decision of the conservative government of England to sell helicopters to South Africa. Before on this program, I have said that many well-meaning liberals feel that by backing a campaign to stop Polaroid from dealing with South Africa or to influence other American corporations is a meaningful way to affect policy of this government and of the government of South Africa. Actually, it is clear that only an overthrow of the government of South Africa will bring any type of democracy to the black majority. And it was quite interesting to see that Frank Nielsen, in his testimony before the Senate committee, who is the head of the African American Institute in Washington, and a conservative, he has come to this position also, that the liberals are simply fooling themselves when they try to get American corporations to slap the South African government on the wrist and thereby change its policy. There is no possibility of that. And the only meaningful way for people of goodwill to support the black people of Southern Africa in their attempt to gain a status of humanity and the right of self-determination is by backing the burgeoning guerrilla movement that is flourishing in Angola and Mozambique and is beginning in South Africa.
You've been listening to the commentary of Conrad Lynn, Lawyer for the Left, a program independently produced by Conrad Lynn. The time is 6 o'clock. You're tuned to listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, at 99.5 FM.
In this program, which was broadcast originally in October as a public affairs special, Andy Stapp, organizer of the Committee for GI Rights and editor-in-chief of The Bond, is interviewed by WBAI's Barry Singer.
I'm talking with a most unusual soldier, one whom I think the U.S. government would have rather have dodged the draft than enlisted. His name is Andy Stapp, and they had a big article on him in Esquire for unionizing the Army. And why did you enlist, and generally, what are you trying to do, or what did you try to do in the Army?
Well, Barry, I enlisted in the Army with the idea of organizing against the war from inside the Army. When I didn't enlist. I asked to be drafted. It's tantamount to the same thing, except I only had 2 years instead of three. But I went in with this idea. I didn't go in with the idea of organizing a union inside the Army, because it was only after I'd been in the Army for a year that I began to realize this was possible. I had a great deal of anti-war literature with me when I went in, and I continued to receive a lot, show it to the GIs and talk to them and stuff about the war. And this precipitated a struggle inside the Army, because the brass tried to deny us our right to read and our right to think. They ordered me to turn over all my literature to them, and I refused. They chopped open my locker with an axe, court-martialed me, and this was sort of the beginning of massive organizing of GIs in the Fort Sill area, anyway.
Well, you went through three court-martials and quite a trying time in the Army. What was the charges of the first court-martial, and what was that like?
The first court-martial was the charge was failure to obey a direct order from a lawful order from a superior officer. He ordered me to turn over my books. Now, under Army Regulation 381-135 and various other regulations, I had a right to keep any literature I wanted. I refused to turn it over. Now, I received a court-martial for this on June 1st, 1967. This time, the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, David Ryan, flew to Fort Sill to take the case. Seven members of Youth Against War and Fascism came down in support, because they had received a bulletin from the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee about the court-martial, and a number of GIs, five to be exact, put on, dressed in their spiffy Class A uniforms and went to the trial to attend it. The trial was pretty typical of Army court-martials, totally ludicrous. The prosecutor, if I hadn't had a lawyer, the judge is the same as the jury, and he's also the defense counsel. It's one guy. It would have been Captain Bartholomew. Now, just to give you a quick rundown of what the trial was like, the main government prosecution witness perjured himself and admitted that he lied right there on the stand. They also admitted that they had violated two Army regulations pertaining to free speech, plus the First and Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Also admitted that the court-martial papers had been signed by the wrong man, that the judge was sitting there illegally because he was only a captain, and it would have had to be at least a colonel for this case. In general, it was, patently fraudulent. Everybody there could see it was, including the battalion intelligence clerk who jumped up and denounced the trial as it ended. He was arrested for disrespect and court-martialed himself for that. But anyway, it didn't make any difference, as these trials always show. The brass has it stacked. I was convicted, sentenced to 45 days hard labor, and a permanent bust to the lowest rank. Two-thirds of my pay was taken. But in a way, it was a big victory. They got their conviction, but we got the support of a lot of guys on the base, and the brass felt they had to retaliate. Well, they court-martialed me again, and that was on July 31st. I was court-martialed with Dick Perrin, another GI there, who had sent a statement into the National Guardian. Dick's now in Germany. He's a deserter, editing a newspaper called ACT. We were court-martialed on July 31st, and this time the Army went all out. I mean, total hysteria. They had a guy with a machine gun escorting me around. They had fire hoses stretched all over the place. Helicopter flying above the building.
You had your own helicopter.
That's right. They had troops with fixed bayonets ringing the building. The same thing at Dick's trial that afternoon. Two individuals who came to the base in our support, Key Martin and Marianne Weissman, were General Brown had ordered them to stay away from the base, but they came on anyway to show solidarity, and they were each arrested, sentenced to 6 months in prison, which they had to serve, and they did serve, just getting out last April. Despite all this paraphernalia of repression and everything that the Army had encircled the court building in, they didn't have any evidence to present inside the building, so I was found not guilty, which is sort of funny. Dick had been charged on a very minor thing, going downtown without a pass. He was given 30 days in the stockade. He was handcuffed and taken over to the stockade at Rifle Point. He was kept in solitary confinement. Actually, they never kept him in the stockade proper. He was kept in the basement of the MP station. But even this spurred on radicalizing activity among the soldiers. For instance, Dick's guard went AWOL that afternoon. He couldn't take it anymore, and they picked him up in Texas about 2 weeks later. It just seemed like every time they hit us, they got it back twice as hard. None of these court martials, they just all blew up in the Army's face. And finally, in February, by now we had the concept of organizing a union because we could see how bitter the feeling of the guys was against the officers. And in February, the Army set up a union busting field board hearing in which a board of colonels examined our activities. I was discharged from the Army because of this.
Well, what did the Army try to do as far as discouraging the men from associating with you after these trials?
Well, they arrested guys downtown for suspicion of burglary, held them for 72 hours, and then released them. A couple guys were sent to Vietnam, but then some guys that were due to go to Vietnam never went because they were interested in fighting for the Union and that sort of thing. The Army's main idea of discouraging us was to discharge me from the Army with an undesirable discharge, but that doesn't frighten anyone. Those guys hate the Army so much that to many, many guys, a discharge can't be undesirable, you know. Let me tell you a little bit about what some of the Union demands are so you can see how why the Army was so frightened by them and why the guys were so attracted. We didn't have formal demands at first. We took the union step by step. First, we just talked about the idea of a union. Then, when the Rodney O'Shea case came up, Rodney was a clerk in one of the units, a Japanese-American, and he was attacked by a racist officer named Bienkowski, who had him court-martialed because Rodney had forgotten to say sir when speaking to this officer. And of course, a Japanese-American GI has to say sir to a white officer. That's automatic. Well, we passed the hat in the barracks, and we said, look, if we had a union, we could defend Oshiro, and we said, this is how we could do it. And so we passed the hat, raised the money, got the lawyer, and of course, Rodney did lose the case, but he put up, it was a big fight, and the guys saw that he didn't get railroaded without a struggle. So at that point, the interest in the union trebled, you know. I mean, guys were really interested then, and so we started formulating demands, and we met. I took a leave, and we met at a conference in New York City, guys from the Navy and the Air Force and the Army. And this conference at the time was not advertised because it's hard to get leaves for these things. We did meet in New York City and we hammered out eight demands, which These demands are an end to saluting and serving of officers, election of officers by the vote of the men, racial equality, rank and file or control of court-martial boards, enlisted control of court-martial boards, that is, federal minimum wages, the right of free political association, and the right to disobey legal orders, like orders to go fight in Vietnam, and finally the right of collective bargaining. These are the union demands, and these are the issues that we struggle around.
On one of those demands, it's the right for the enlisted men to elect offices. Wasn't that tried in the Soviet Army in the, I think in the 20s or?
Yeah, well, initially this is true, it was. Of course, Soviet Union isn't exactly our model for, or the Soviet Army, I mean, isn't exactly our model for what we would want the Union of the United States Army to be like. And they do have election of cadre in the Chinese Army. And so it is possible to do. I'm sure that the men couldn't pick officers any worse than the ones that we've got now. So, for instance, in the Chinese Army, officers, I read this in a U.S. Army pamphlet, which was written to scare U.S. Army officers, written by officers to scare other officers. Enlisted men weren't supposed to read it, but I got a glimpse of it and read through it. It said that Chinese Army officers have to serve, all of them have to serve 1 month a year at the rank of private. And it said, as this pamphlet was being written, 150,000 Chinese Army officers were serving their stint as private, including 160 generals. So and their army doesn't seem to be on the verge of collapse. It seems to be one of the most stable institutions in the country at this point. I think these democratic ideas are conceivable.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from officers on these demands? Have you ever gotten any favorable reaction on the part of any brass, either low or high ranking?
Well, maybe people like Captain Levy and others like him would be in favor of it. I know I heard from someone that he didn't salute the men. He used to shake hands with them and stuff. Of course, the other officers put him in jail. I do know that the reaction of the officers to the union has been one of absolute rage and terror. I could cite example after example of that. For instance, Fred Patrick, this sailor who just went on trial in the Brooklyn Naval Yard, well, he's a union organizer there. He's organized 25 sailors into the Army at that naval base. His trial came up about a month ago, and we put up the union put up a picket line outside of the trial, and then we went in to attend it after the trial began. While they had a machine gun set up on the roof of the building. Colonel Teef had, there were Marines all over the place with flak jackets, M1 carbines, and all kinds of ammunition and stuff that that they generally don't have at court-martials like this. So they were extremely unnerved by the idea of having a union guy on trial. A guy that openly said that he was in the union. It was very frightening for them. I've seen this at Fort Hood. I've seen it, for instance, one of our union organizers, Dick Wheaton, was just discharged from Fort Sill, and he was barred under penalty of 6 months in prison from ever returning. He'd been there as a soldier for 3 years, but the day he was discharged, they barred him under penalty of 6 months in prison. And in every area, for instance, the brass in Hawaii put out a bulletin on the union and advising the lower-ranking officers to search diligently for union literature and this sort of thing. So the reaction from the officers has been one of total hostility, as we would expect it to, because we're totally hostile to them.
What is the state of union literature? Is it legal?
Sure, it's legal, but the Army, the Armed Forces, is prepared to violate any law. I mean, under the First Amendment of the Constitution, you have a right to freedom of the press, right to freedom of speech, and no Pentagon regulation can take that away from you, because the Constitution is supposed to be the highest law of the land. Now, we know there's no freedom of speech for the Vietnamese that are napalmed, or there's no freedom of speech for the people in the Congo that were killed by CIA pilots or anything like that. These people don't have freedom of speech, and to a certain extent, GIs don't have freedom of speech, to a certain large extent, I'd say. For instance, these two Marines, George Daniels and William Harvey, they were members of the 1st Marine Division on the West Coast, Afro-American guys. And they made statements, they were alleged to have made statements, that went like this. This is pretty much a direct quote. Vietnam is a white man's war. Black men shouldn't fight in Vietnam because they'll only have to come back to the United States and fight white racists here, unquote. That's the statement they made. Now, they were put on trial for subversion, and they wanted to get civilian lawyers, but the Navy advised them not to, because they said, look, we'll let you off light if you don't. Well, they were double-crossed. Harvey got 10 years, which he's now serving. Or Daniels got 10 years, and Harvey got 6. They're serving it up at Portsmouth now. There's a lawyer on the case, and the Servicemen's Union has organized picket lines in their support. It's a tremendously important case of racism. It exposes, you know, there's this myth that there's no racism in the Army, and yet that's perhaps, along with the suppression of Martin Soster in Buffalo and, you know, Rap Brown and others, this is one of the most blatant acts of racism that I know of. I mean, when you talk about illegal lynching, that's what you mean. You know what the judge said to Daniels? He said, you were convicted on 8 counts of this, meaning that Daniels had supposedly made this statement 8 times. Not written it out, but just said it to the guys, you know. He said, now each count carries 10 years, Daniels, and I could have given you 80 years. I'm letting you off light with 10. That's what they meant by letting these guys off light. The guys didn't have any lawyers at all, except military lawyers who were, you know, they work in collaboration with their brother officers. Of course, these black men had a right under the First Amendment to make these statements. Martin Luther King and, well, of course, his freedom of speech has been denied to him now, too. But many, many black people have made these statements, so-called respectable black people, you know, high black officials, and the Kerner Commission even made statements similar to this. And yet, Harvey and Daniels are doing 16 years in prison for saying this to the guys.
Do you happen to know offhand what the catch-all military law is that allows them to clamp down and do whatever they want?
It's Article 134 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which the servicemen, the GIs, call the Ununiform Code of Military Injustice. This Article 134 supposedly deals with, well, it does. It deals with supposed subversion, say. In Harvey and Daniels' case, they were not only charged with violating Article 134, but they were also charged with violating U.S. Code 2387, Title 18, which is a civilian subversion statute, which was used during World War I against Wobblies and, you know, stuff like that.
Are you sure there was no Catch-22 involved in that either? What about the reaction of the Army brass after they realized that you were a troublemaker as far as relating you to the other men? Did they have any kind of forewarning to wherever you were assigned?
Well, they used massive red baiting. If, you know, since I was white, they couldn't use racism against me. But they did use extensive red baiting, which pretty much fell flat. I was red baited continuously for at least a year, and I mean like on a very sustained and systematic basis, like in the newspapers that all the GIs read, that kind of thing, the Oklahoma Press. The whole time I was in a barracks with 40 or 50 GIs in the one room. You know, we're not like officers that have each our little room. Well, that whole time, and I was moved from barracks to barracks quite a bit, too. And that whole time, I never had a serious confrontation with another GI. That doesn't mean that some of them weren't anti-communist, because some of them were, but they hated the officers worse. And I had certainly never done anything to mess over a GI, but the colonel had. And their reaction was, well, if Stapp's putting it to the colonel, then he can't be all bad, you know. Then there were a lot of guys who were attracted by this, because red baiting is beginning to backfire, too.